All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. So I have some big news, some big exciting news to share with you all today. Some of you may know it if you've been following me on social media already. But before I get to it, a little history lesson. I guess it was 2 years and 2 months ago when I first interviewed Amp Tech Skip Simmons on this podcast. He was a Fretboard Journal subject, and I wanted to collect a bunch of questions from you all on how tube amps work, how to keep them going, how to fix them up, how to find your next Amp Tech. Skip and I had an amazing chat. It was one of our most downloaded episodes at the time. And we had so much fun, and it was so informative, I basically gave him the keys to his own podcast, which is called The Truth About Vintage Amps. We are up to 60 episodes of that podcast. I'm the co-host, Ed McMahon type, whatever you want to call me, maybe Andy Richter, I don't know. We field questions from around the world. The growth that that podcast has had, the feedback, the community has been overwhelming, to say the least. We have had so much fun doing it. I think Skip and I are both constantly floored by just how much interest it's been getting. And one of our listeners of that podcast had a brilliant idea. He said, I love what you've done with demystifying the world of tube amps. How about doing a similar show about recording and mixing? Now, this is a vast subject, and I am not the right guy to be doing this job. So I tapped my dear friend, Johnny Sangster, today's Fretboard Journal podcast guest, and he is going to be hosting one of a handful of new shows that we're launching in January of 2021. And because we save all our creativity for the magazine and our story ideas, we have the very unimaginative title for it of The Truth About Recording and Mixing. Johnny is a local Seattle music hero. He has a studio called Crackle and Pop that's just about a half mile from where I'm sitting at the Fretboard Journal headquarters. He is an incredible musician. You may have seen him on the road playing guitar with Nico Case. And I think it's going to be a ton of fun. So the episode you are about to hear right now is sort of the pilot, I guess. It's me, like me, talking to Skip back in November of 2018. We're going to be setting the tone, introducing you to Johnny, and going forward, you can send Johnny all of your questions and suggestions and topics and voice memos to podcast@fretboardjournal.com, and we will be playing the best of those and reading the best of those on future Truth About Recording and Mixing episodes. And it's going to be a fun, cool, organic, super helpful show. Johnny is taking the ball and running with it. His format is going to be slightly different than the Amp Podcast one in that he's going to be reaching out to people from the community, industry veterans, some pretty big names in the world of recording and mixing and mastering on a regular basis. So it's going to be kind of a star-studded affair. I think it's going to be pretty fun and a lot of great information. And I think it's going to be, just like that Amp Podcast, a tremendous resource. We, of course, have the other podcast that we do, Luthier on Luthier with Michael Bashkin, which is about to celebrate its 50th episode, so I want everyone to go check that out if you haven't yet. Even if you're not a guitar maker, you're going to love hearing from these people. It's Michael Bashkin interviewing some of his favorite guitar makers. He is, of course, a great guitar maker himself, and I love it. I love hearing from all these guys. They're all characters and gals. Podcasting has been a great little saving grace for us, given the fact that we haven't been able to really have artists at the Fretboard Journal as we normally do during normal years. But it is definitely not the only thing we're doing. So please be aware, the Fretboard Journal's 47th issue is mailing in just a couple of weeks. We're at that beautiful stage where we've signed off on the magazine and it's in the printer's hands. So there's still time to subscribe and get it. and reserve your copy if you go to fretboardjournal.com. You can also, of course, start with a digital subscription, which is just a PDF that'll be mailed directly to your inbox, viewable on any device. And those are only $30 for 4 issues, no matter where in the world you are. Before we talk to Johnny, a quick shout out to a couple of our sponsors. First up is Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and studio monitor stands, pedal board bags, pedal boards, you name it. Everything they make is so beautifully designed and ergonomic and bulletproof. I love seeing all their new products whenever there is a NAMM show. There's obviously not a real NAMM show. There's a virtual one this January, but I love all their products, and so I hope you will check them out. We also are sponsored again by Folkway Music, Canada's premier acoustic and electric store. I love Folkway Music, one of the great vintage instrument websites around, but you know what? Mark Stutman, proprietor of Folkway, also can write pretty well about new guitars too. So go on over there and check out their inventory, especially if you live in Canada. And even if you don't live in Canada, Mark is the guy for a lot of really high-end vintage Martin and Gibson restoration work. So hit him up for that, or follow him on Instagram if you just want to see how the sausage gets made, or I should say repaired. And then last up, we have Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York City, another one of my favorite stores in the world. I've used to call them a cabinet of wonders of musical instruments, and I still maintain that, because where else are you going to find a 1934 Gibson F10 carved top mandolin with the like tuxedo finish, the beautiful inlays, as well as the black body with the white binding around the pickguard? They have so many cool guitars, and yes, they have Ry Cooter's number one Cooter Caster for sale right now. So head on over there. I saw a Guild M75 Aristocrat for sale over there right now. A lot of gems that you will probably never be able to ever find in your lifetime are available at Retrofret. They get those kinds of guitars that you just do not ever see anywhere else. Thanks to all of our sponsors. All right, without further ado, here is my talk with Johnny Singster, the new host of The Truth About Recording and Mixing. And if anyone out there is listening to this and works for a brand or some company that's a good fit with this podcast, we are looking for sponsors now. So if you want to lock in your space on The Truth About Recording and Mixing, reach out to me, podcast@fretboardjournal.com. We'd love to talk to you. There's really no other podcast like this out there with this exact format, and I think everyone is going to really love it. Johnny Singster, great to see you.
Yeah,
actually,
likewise.
See, I haven't done an interview. I mean, there is a glass wall and
10
feet between us,
right?
But I haven't done an interview in a long time. So thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So this came about, this interview. I mean, I've known you forever. You've been an incredible resource. You're down the street from the Fretboard Journal. We've hit you up for all sorts of projects over the years.
A little recording, a little advice, a little this and that.
Yeah. But one of our, we've been doing this Truth About Vintage Amps podcast for 2 years now, and one of our listeners, Dave in Denver, I forget your last name, Dave, said, why isn't there a Truth About Vintage Amps about recording and mixing and home recording?
Right.
And I thought, maybe we should do what we did with Skip 2.5 years ago and get you on the podcast, ask you some questions and get your story.
Sure.
See what happens.
Yeah. I don't consider myself an expert necessarily, but I've been doing it a long time, so I can probably answer some questions.
As long as you're a curmudgeon, an expert, or want to act like an expert, you're in.
I want to be a curmudgeon.
All right. Give,
I'm trying.
You're still young.
Yeah.
So before we get to some questions and some recording basics, which I will lean on you for, I'm sitting here in this amazing studio in Seattle's Ballard neighborhood where all sorts of great bands have continued to record at.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see a thriving recording studio in 2020.
Yeah. Well, it's grown. A couple years ago, we went from a little tiny room to a twice as big room.
Yeah.
So that's been encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm surrounded by all this cool gear. How did all this come to be? Where did you grew up in this area, right?
I grew up in Seattle. Yeah. And so early on, was one of those guys who had a cassette that could overdub. I had actually the first Sin cassette, which was a two-track overdubbing cassette made by Tiak. That was the early, actually, you know, even before that, I think there was a music teacher up on Lopez High School that lent us a reel-to-reel tape deck that we could overdub on. So I got the bug really early. I was probably in the sixth or seventh grade when I started messing around with tape decks.
What kind of music were you guys playing?
Oh, mostly Led Zeppelin covers.
Of course.
Yeah.
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 But your roots, I mean, I know from prior conversations with you, you've kind of, you're steeped in the Pacific Northwest guitar culture a little bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah. With, you know, my dad played guitar. My brother's a musician. He's in the Young Fresh Fellows and the Pickets and lots of other bands. The Tripwires with me and John Ramberg and Dan Peters. And we attended the Puget Sound Guitar Workshop, which is a great community, and learned about other kinds of music than rock and roll out there. Mm-hmm. Lots of folk and, you know, Balkan folk tunes and some blues and Irish music. And so that was an eye-opener.
Yeah. That is a gem.
And yeah, and I think that, you know, early on also there was a lot of, you know, music happening in the city. And as young up-and-coming players, there was opportunities to play with some cool bands and see what was going on here.
And is this the classic story of you never set out to start a recording studio, but the stuff in your bedroom kind of grew and grew and grew?
Yeah, actually, I clearly remember at one point thinking that I didn't want to become a studio owner because most of the ones I knew were crazy.
Okay, I love it.
And that, you know, now I understand why they're crazy, and I'm a little crazy myself. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we started the studio here, me and Andrew Smith, who is still my partner. I guess it's 12 years ago, and we had a Digi O2 with some other thing that gave us 16 inputs and 16 outputs, and we had like three good mic pre's and probably a Royer SM57 and a Audio Technica 4033. We had like, you know, a good condenser, a good dynamic, and one good ribbon mic. Yeah. And it was like, okay, we can do overdubs here. So that was 12 years ago. And, you know, certainly I've had a collection of instruments that I've been playing in the bands that I was in. So that's a part of the attraction for people to come here. There's always been good instruments, but the gear side of it has come along slowly since then.
And completely self-taught on your end?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've worked with some good producer engineers early on when I was in bands, and that inspired me to get better at it. And then around 97, I moved. I was living abroad for many years, and I moved back to Seattle and started doing stuff at Egg Studio with Conrad Uno. And that's where I kind of got serious about the engineering side of it.
Okay.
And reading a lot of books and then just asking people questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for folks who haven't checked out your website, who are name drop, give me some names.
People I've worked with.
Yeah.
Maggie Bjorklund, Mudhoney, The Posies. That's about it.
Yeah. Wow.
There's got to be some more.
You've been on the road with Nico Case.
That's true. I play with Nico. I've played with Mark Lanigan some, and then tons of local rock and roll around here. Mm-hmm. Roy Loney, I've played in his band. Roy passed away last year. Done some recording and played with Steve Turner's band when he was doing solo music.
Yeah.
Rusty Willoughby, I play in Llama, which is Rusty's band, and also recorded some other of his solo records. Lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I've learned from Skip Simmons, my co-host on the Amp podcast, is never make the interviews sound like ads, but let me ask a very addish question of you, which is where do you specialize versus the other recording studios in the greater Seattle area? Why do people come to you versus others? What's your niche, if there is one?
Well, I think me as a producer, I come at things as the musical kind of co-director or translator or whatever that I get very involved with, you know, how the song is presented. So that's a production side of it. And then, you know, the studio, really you just want a place that is easy to be in, feels nice, and sounds good. Yeah. So that's something we tried, you know, to make a place that feels really good,
yeah,
comfortable and vibey. And, you know, I learned a lot from Conrad Uno about that. Like, you shouldn't be afraid to spill a beer on the concrete floor or the carpet when you're making a rock record. It should, yeah, feel like, okay, this is cool, and but not too fancy either.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It should be a little scrappy.
Yeah.
It should, you know, like Conrad's place always felt like just a slight upgrade from your practice space.
Yeah.
And I love that about that. You know, it's like, yeah, you come in here to make music, it shouldn't feel too pristine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have, yeah, the gear that could do a garage rock band or a bluegrass record.
Or a jazz record.
Everything,
yeah,
in between.
Yeah, you try to, I mean, you want it to be high quality for sure. You want,
yeah,
it to capture things at the best quality possible. And, you know, that's a constant thing. You're working on your monitoring. You're working on treating the rooms. You're trying to get the acoustics good so that when you put up a mic, it sounds good. The room, yeah, sounds nice. Yeah.
And from before we were rolling, you told me that 2020 has actually been a decent year for you.
It's actually been good. You know, I did a lot of remote mixing at the start of the year. Kind of learned how to stream mixes over the internet so people can participate, mm-hmm, when you're mixing. I did a ton of tape transfers because everybody was digging through the closets to find the 8 tracks from their college bands.
Of course.
So I heard everybody's college bands.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. We have tape decks here. So I did a lot of that, a little transferring. And then, you know, some people will, there's been a lot of like home recordings that have come this way to, mm-hmm, get mixed. People are making records in their bedrooms again.
Of course, buying guitars, making records. So I wasn't going to get to the recording 101 for a few minutes, but it strikes me talking to you that we've dropped a few terms that I will just play the complete idiot.
Okay.
It's a role, yeah, I do really well on everything, the Fretboard Journal.
Uh-huh.
For folks out there who don't know, give me the elevator pitch on what a producer, a mixer, an engineer, and a mastering engineer uh-huh, do, because those are four terms,
sure,
that I think kind of blur sometimes.
Well, also some people do them all.
Some people do them, right, all, and some, yeah, people do none of them, or one,
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, they do one or the other, you know.
So, you know, walk us through.
Yeah, okay, well, traditionally there would be the engineer who would take care of the levels, plug in the microphones, make sure that, you know, all of those connections were being made, and would be hands-on the equipment. The producer was the guy who would come and listen to the arrangement and suggest, you know, maybe this beat in that part of the song, or why don't we get a string section in here? I'm going to call up the arranger. He's, you know, the overall picture guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the producer engineer has kind of developed out of that from the 60s to the, you know, people who went independent who would do both.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where I am. I'm both crafting the sound with my hands on the equipment, but also have a picture of what the band is doing. And that involves, you know, pre-production. Oftentimes it'll be, say it's a rock band, you get together a couple times in the practice space and start honing in on, okay, what's happening when you go to the B section of this song? Is the, you know, bass and drums matching up? Would it be cooler to drop out that guitar for a second? And, you know, so those sort of things is what the producer looks at. But then also just like the overall, what's the sound we're trying to get? Like, mm-hmm, is it going to be a 70s kind of drum tone and sort of record, or is it going to be really modern? You know, that's the producer's role to have that overarching picture for,
okay,
it.
Okay.
Yeah. Mixing, of course, is an art in itself and takes years to get good at, because you have to make all the mistakes.
Okay.
To not make the mistakes anymore.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you develop your own techniques on how you mix and how you make something work as a mix. And that, you know, is taking your multi-track recording that you've tracked the basic tracks with the band and done your overdubs and then put strings on, and you're blending all those elements together using either a mixing console or just a computer DAW,
uh-huh,
to, you know, put it all together. Then you end up with a stereo file, a stereo mix that's just left and right, so two channels.
Okay.
So coming from, you know, a multi-track thing down to two channels. That is the product that you then send to the mastering engineer, whose job is to put together a sequence of songs for a record so that they flow evenly between each other.
Okay.
So, you might take a week or 10 days to mix your record, and there's going to be subtle differences in the response of each one of those mixes because of the instruments used. They're not going to come out sounding exactly even across the course of a 35-minute, 40-minute record. So the mastering engineer's job is to then even out those differences, but also to bring it up to a level, a playback level, that feels good on most people's systems. So okay. There's both a dynamic range component to mastering, kind of controlling how loud and quiet things get per song, but also matching them up song to song. And that's also the final step in, you know, putting together a collection of songs before it gets released. Okay. So even down to the spacing between the songs, that's the mastering engineer's job.
Okay.
And it's hard. It sounds easy, but it's really hard. It's hard for me too, and I do occasionally master records for people. I try not to do that for the records that I mix, because I like for my work to go to a different room and to be heard by different ears and to have that little distance to it and somebody else's take on how to get it the final step there.
Okay. Yeah, it's the alchemy there is slightly confusing or nebulous, because in my head I'm like, well, if the mixing guy did his job properly,
right,
do we need the mastering guy? But it sounds like we do need the mastering guy.
Yeah, yeah. The mastering is the kind of final step that makes it all, you know, cohesive. And really, it is in the course of an album, traditionally. But there is some tricks that you can do to a mix to make it more presentable. Mm-hmm. Even just as a standalone song.
Mm-hmm. Now we're gonna. Somebody will use the old food analogy of all the ingredients make the recipe.
Right.
But where obviously recording, you need to record up front properly.
Sure.
What are the most important elements if you had to pick three?
With the food analogy?
Well, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
No, I was just curious, like. Is it okay? Where, if somebody were to skimp, would they skimp? I'm guessing they normally would skimp on the mastering guy because they're like a home recording guy, or you know. Or,
well, but oftentimes, like, you need the mastering guy all the more for the home recording stuff, because you know you're mixing in an environment that isn't the greatest.
Yes.
If you're mixing at home, you're either mixing on headphones or a set of speakers that aren't as good as what you would have in a mixing studio or a mastering studio.
Yeah.
So for sure, mastering comes into play there.
Yeah.
In a big way. But yeah, I think, you know, capturing good sounds up front is the best thing to do.
Sure.
But every situation is kind of compromised, and it shouldn't get in the way of capturing something. You
yeah.
know, like
yeah.
if you have a 57, that's great. You know, you have mm-hmm. a crappy little interface, great. You don't have a compressor, fine. You know, all these things help get it there, but shouldn't stop you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your role as a producer, you were saying, you know, sometimes you're meeting the bands at the practice space, you know, coaching them on drum sounds or whatever. So not to be crass, but I'm guessing at that point you're not on payroll. You're just a friend helping out people in the music community. And then eventually they're like, let's bring you into the fold and write you a check. Or how does that work?
Well, I do, depending on the budget.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that the producer has to take into, you know, account is...
The budget.
The budget. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, you know, part of my role. And that's, I, you know, consider that a part of my day rate, hourly rate. And I will, you know, ask for money if the feels like there's budget there
yeah.
to have me come to your practice space. But if there's no budget, then let's see if we can make it work anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely my work is sliding scale in that sense. Like, how much do I want to do it?
Yeah.
Do I love this band? How far am I willing to, you know, bend out of my, you know, comfort zone? As I do need to get paid for sure, but
yeah.
it's flexible, you know.
And do you hate inheriting someone else's mess, or do you enjoy the challenge of that?
Depends.
Okay.
Sometimes, I mean, if you're talking about getting a folder full of audio files that I have to mix
yeah.
into something,
yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's really challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, something I'm learning this year too, because there's been some projects where we should have recorded it at a studio but couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten some things that, yeah, I mean, I would have done them differently,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it will take me longer to sort it out and edit it together and, you know, use every trick I have on the post end to mm-hmm. make it right. Yeah.
I try not to ask too many questions that are COVID related just because I'd like to think that we'll be eventually not talking about
it. Yeah, right.
But has COVID changed the process? I mean, everybody's seen the footage of their favorite band behind the mixing board with the engineer listening in on the studio monitors. Are you now doing some of that remote?
Yes.
You are. Yeah. How does that work?
Well, typically I'm just sending a file and they're listening to it on their home system and then we get on the phone.
Okay.
But I've been using Listen to makes a plugin, or maybe it's Hearback. I forget the name of the company. I'll find that out. But there's a streaming plugin that you can put in a Pro Tool session.
Okay.
And it basically just streams it over the internet and you can send them a browser link to plug in. So that's been useful for some things where you're actually, you know, honing in on like an echo in a certain verse and they have an idea like it's got to be just this way. You can actually do it real time, so I can get a Zoom call going.
Okay.
And I can go, how about this? Okay, I'm going to turn that up right now. And they're like, oh, that's pretty good, but try it, you know, a little more on that word. And, you know, so that's been a nice way to be able to like collaborate in real time on mixing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you just pray that on the other end, they have decent ways to listen to this.
Right. Well, that is interesting because the bit rate it can go out with depends completely on my internet connection, which is not great here.
Oh,
okay. And their internet connection, whether they can hear it properly. And so that was one thing, you know, like, well, it's not sounding great. And I was like, okay, hold on a second. I'll print a file and send it to you.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's a WAV file and they can hear that. And, but yeah, if they don't have good monitors or good headphones, then I don't know what that sounds like to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just get into nuts and bolts, I guess.
Sure.
If you had to recommend a pair of monitor headphones, which would, as I know from podcasting, would be very different than the headphones you'd go listen to a Pink Floyd record.
See, that's where I'm not very good. I'm not very good with those, like, you know, what's the best one?
Uh-huh.
I'm using Audio Technica, like, cheapo headphones. Well, they're like $75 a pair.
Okay.
They're the Audio Technica 30s, 40s.
M35s.
Yeah.
M35s.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're durable and they sound decent and you can drop them on the floor and pull them out of the jack and abuse them. So, but I actually I'm looking for a better set of headphones. I don't really mix on headphones anymore.
Okay.
I will plug in and listen to it, but I don't trust them to actually mix on. And I think that's good advice for most people.
Actually invest in studio monitors.
Yes. And then spend some time setting them up in a place in your room that seems like it's fairly flat. That doesn't mean like on a shelf on the wall. It has to be back from the wall a little bit of ways. And then there's a ton we can talk about treating a room to stop reflections and to identify problems with a room. Oftentimes that's, you know, the bass will sound great 7 feet away from where you're sitting, but where you're sitting and mixing, you can't hear the bass. And that's placement of speakers and it's treatment of room. So, you know, sound treatment.
Let's hear what are there a top 3 or 5 things folks can do if they're, you know, carved out a little section of their basement or their guest room to do this stuff?
Sure. Like a ceiling cloud. So one of the things you want to eliminate is the first reflection off of a wall.
Okay.
In this room, it's a little funky, but one of the things we've done, we built the walls so they splay out from the front to the back.
Yes.
So that, you know, pushes the reflection further back behind my head and they're not parallel. But if I didn't have that, then I would probably hang something on the right side and the left side that stopped the first reflection from being so loud. And the same thing above my head. I would hang a ceiling cloud, especially if it's a low ceiling, because what's happening is the, you know, sound is bouncing both off the top and coming back.
Yes.
And that's interfering with the direct sound off of the speakers. And it's blurring the sound and it's, you know, causing some some issues.
Yes. No one will be able to see this. Maybe I'll take some pictures, but it looks like you have a couple of IKEA CD racks hanging on the ceiling above your head. But the ceiling is not flat. It is at an angle, as
the
you described.
The ceiling angles up about a foot and a half from the front to the back of the room. And yeah, those they look like CD racks. They actually have what's called Corning 703 insulation, which is what I've built all of the traps around here. It's a stiff insulation board that you can cut up, and it stays stiff, and then you can place it in these enclosures to absorb the sound. The reason why that there's the slats on that is that you are also trying to diffuse the sound as well as stop it. So you don't want to completely deaden down your room. If you have carpet all the way around you, then you're not hearing any high end. Mm. And if you do that, then your mixes are going to be really bright because you're not hearing the top end. It's just getting sucked up. So you do want to slow down, you know, the low end build up in a room, which is what this big soffit is for.
Okay. Yeah.
That is actually a bass trap. So that's, you know, any low end buildup that's happening in the room, that's helping to slow that down. These things, these CD shelves, are scattering the sound, so it's not just one straight reflection. It's actually scattering it out in different directions, but it's not killing it entirely. It's diffusing it.
This is getting complicated already.
I know. So that's...
How have your ears and your sense of hearing developed over the years? Because that is something where... I can imagine if you threw me into your job, Walter Mitty style, I would immediately start to question whether what I'm hearing is what I should be hearing.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that happen? Is it just hours and hours of doing it?
I think it's hours of doing it and then, you know, figuring out how it translates when you leave the room as well. Because that is the ultimate goal. It's like, yes. I'm mixing and it sounds great right here, but as soon as I go to my car, it sounds like crap.
Yeah. I do always...
That is the thing that everybody, you know, when you were back in bands, you like make a cassette and go listen in your car, right? See how it's translating. So, you know, there's different ways of changing your perspective. One thing, I have these little tiny Avantone mix cubes here.
Okay.
Their function is a little bit like how people use the NS10 monitor, where it's like a focused mid-range sound. And it's not as full range. And oftentimes I'll just go to one of those speakers and flip it to mono, play it kind of quiet. And what that does is it tells me where all of the mid-range elements are sitting in a mix. So the guitar versus the snare drum versus the lead vocal. All of those things kind of sit in the same frequency range in a mix, but it's really important that you can hear them all clearly. So by... going away from the big picture, nice full range big speakers and going down to a smaller focus speaker, you can actually identify, you know, is the level right, basically. Yeah. You know, you're balancing those elements.
And are those expensive?
No, those are quite affordable.
Quite affordable.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you only need one.
Yeah. There's oftentimes like they're based on the Oratone speaker, which is a little wooden cube that, you know, and people would just have one in mono. And I think back in the day, I was like, well, we need to make sure it comes out of the television speaker okay. So let's listen to this Oratone, which is kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I edit all of our podcasts that I have something to do with in Adobe Audition because we're using Adobe products to put out a magazine. And
yeah.
I've already got the subscription. It's what I know how to use. And it is always remarkable. I will more often than not export the podcast to my phone, take it to my car and go drive around the block, ahead.
Sure.
And you always discover things that even though you're, you know, have the headphones on or listening through speakers, you never hear otherwise.
Right. And it's hard to hear those level differences that are happening.
It's completely.
You know, the dynamic range. And, you know, the car is a good test also if you're driving because some things will fall below what's acceptable range.
Yeah.
Be too quiet. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, I have no excuses for why the Fretboard Journal podcast sounds so poor, but it does.
Oh, I'm sure it sounds great. Yeah.
Thank you. It will today, if nothing else.
You know, if the music's good, it doesn't matter how good the quality is. It's all about the content.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what are I'm not gonna grill you over specific products today.
Okay.
But we will in the future.
Yeah. I mean, give me a heads up.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that.
We'll get experts. Yeah. We'll get you. We'll do all our research.
Right.
But I do want to ask a couple of questions that I think have a broad range, which is the most common mistakes you see from people who are recording at home or in a really rinky-dink studio that you then inherit. Are there a handful of things where you're just like, please stop doing this?
Yeah. Well, one is clipping your converters on the way in.
Okay.
Because that cannot be undone.
Clipping I know what clipping is. Yeah. So, but what is clipping
your converter? So if your level is going into the red on a digital converter.
Okay.
Hardly anybody's recording to tape, although hopefully some of you are out there.
Oh, sure.
Tape is more forgiving about overloading, but when you clip into a converter, it creates a square wave and it doesn't sound good.
Yes.
And there are some ways to undo that, and probably the folks at iZotope would raise their hands and go, we can fix that.
Yep.
And those tools work great, but it's not, that's a total pain in the ass to get files in that are clipped. It's ugly and can't be undone very well.
Mm-hmm.
An electric guitar that's clipped on the way in will never, you just don't want to turn it up. It sounds bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one. I guess, drum recording is a real challenge. Oh, and the more microphones that you get on an instrument, the more you have phasing issues.
Uh-huh.
And usually with a drum kit, that's all about the distance between the sources. So you have a kick drum mic, you have a snare drum mic, you have some overhead mics. The snare drum is going into all of those mics. All of the drums are going into all of the mics at the same time.
Sure.
But they're at different distances, so that's causing all of this problems. So understanding how to check for phase discrepancies and how to correct that.
There obviously is a way to
correct
absolutely.
It. We've had
80 years of rock and roll. Or...
There is the, most mic preamplifiers have a phase switch, a polarity switch, which flips the positive to the negative.
Okay.
So that's one thing you can make sure that all those are in the right position, and that's just experimenting.
Okay.
So overhead is picking up the snare drum. You can flip the phase on the overhead or the snare drum and see which one produces a more full sound. You can, in detail in post, you can actually scoot things and time align them, but then you're kind of messing with things that, making it overly complicated. But really it's about mic placement.
Okay.
And checking your polarity. Mm-hmm. So to get a good drum sound with more than 3 mics, it takes just futzing with that, learning how to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other common mistakes? There's plenty. But.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, acoustics in the room that you're recording in are important.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to, because, you can get right up on a mic and be super close and avoid the acoustics in some ways. But it's nice to capture some acoustics. It gives the recording some life.
Yeah.
So trying to figure out what sounds good in a room and where to place the mic and place the source, especially acoustic guitars and singers and cellos, and all of those need some air around them. So if you're right up on the instrument, it's not going to sound natural. You want to get the mic back a little ways. But as soon as you get the mic back a little ways, then you have the environment to deal with. And the environment can sometimes be traffic outside or, all of these things play into it. So finding a good balance with those things can really make a difference.
Well, and I imagine that's a challenge for 90% of the people who are probably listening to this who record at home by themselves.
Exactly, yeah.
We famously, when we interviewed Robert Keeley, he famously told us an oft-quoted thing about Julian Lage using one of their looper pedals because he would play himself, he'd play through it in soundcheck, loop it, and then go to the back of the room so he could hear how his amp sound,
because that's cool.
He's traveling with a guitar. But an acoustic guitarist in their little studio doesn't have that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they'd do.
Well, you record it,
and then just
listen to it,
tuning.
And then you go, okay, well, what if I put it there? And, And one of the great things about moving into this space and getting the acoustics dialed in is that I am pulling the mics further back. Yeah. Where we were upstairs and, you know, I had a little booth and it was heavily treated. But even with all the heavily treatment in there, it was still like a little rectangle with all parallel walls. And I couldn't make it sound natural. So I was right up on the instruments trying to avoid the acoustics of the room. So
got it.
The more you can dial in the acoustics of your room, the easier your job is. You can hear things better. The things sound better live in the room. And then it's easier to stick a mic up and capture it.
Do the crude... grabbing clothespins and putting your Pendleton blanket up against the windows.
Sure.
That stuff
works? Absolutely, yeah. Like, you know, hard reflective surfaces, if you can slow those down, that's great. And there's, you know, lots of DIY things you can build.
Yes.
You know, acoustical treatment that you can build. And it's not hard. And it's not expensive either.
Yeah.
The first stuff I had was just those sheets of Corning 703 wrapped in fabric. And then you just build little tents around it. Slow down the sound.
Yeah. Everyone, if you've made it this far, should get a free subscription to Tape Op and read
Absolutely.
It religiously.
Absolutely, yeah. Tape Op magazine has, has brought up a whole generation of engineers, and it's the greatest.
It is.
Yeah.
What are everybody likes to geek out on gear. People fight over Mac versus PC. I mentioned an Audition. I think we're recording in GarageBand right now.
At the Pro Tools.
Pro Tools.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, though, most of the things, even I think, maybe I don't know this, don't quote me, but even like Audacity lets you export to a medium that is can be opened on any Pro Tools
Absolutely.
Computer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the name of that file?
A WAV file?
I thought there was a way to export the individual tracks to like the whole structure, but maybe
no. That actually still, there's the OMF.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I've
never played with that.
I've yet to see it work.
Okay.
I think theoretically it can work, but for the most part, if I'm sharing a session with somebody who's working in a different DAW, I'll just make files that start at zero. Continue to the end of, so I'll make a new file that isn't split up into little tiny pieces.
Okay.
Just contiguous files from zero to the end of the song. That is the best way to avoid issues, timing issues or, the backing vocal isn't sitting where it's supposed to be. Those things. Yeah.
There are dozens of home recording field recorder things. I use one all the time, the Zoom F4 for a lot of fretboard journal interviews and projects. There obviously are also hundreds of ways to get your microphone to talk to your computer directly.
Yes.
Do you have a preference in terms of a guy at home or a woman at home wants to get their songs down? Should they invest in the little thing that they can move from room to room, or should they just focus on getting their music into their computer?
The thing that they can move from room to room.
the little Zoom recorder or the little handheld recorder.
Oh.
Versus that records to a little card versus.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, it kind of just depends on your workflow.
Yeah.
For some people, I think the computer is great. You can see the tracks and visualize and has a little mixer. Whereas the Zoom recorder has a ton of functions, but like three buttons.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to learn all the menus and navigating around. And I know you can multitrack in a Zoom recorder. It's been a while since I've seen a new one. But the one I have, which is probably 8 or 9 years old, I would never make a four-track recording on it. It's too complicated with the three buttons to make it work.
They've added more buttons. Don't you worry.
That being said, a four-track cassette deck, that makes total sense in my mind. It's got, four plugs for the mics and four tracks. And so you can do that. But I think that for most people, an interface that has a mic and an instrument input, and if you're going to be recording anything that needs more than two mics, then you need to get one that has eight inputs.
Yeah.
And there's a ton of different options out there. And I do look at them. I don't know exactly which one I would buy, but, it seems like for under $500, you can get easily eight inputs. And then you could have a setup where you had, the bass goes in there and there's a little, two or three for the drums over here. And that would work great.
I'm thinking typical Fretboard Journal reader, podcast listener.
Yeah.
Probably has some nice guitars.
Yeah.
Maybe doesn't have a great mic computer setup.
Yeah.
What would be your recommendations, broadly speaking, of like the three or four things that they should get. Anything in terms of a computer interface, mics. We should talk about mics.
Yeah.
Condenser mic or
sure.
You know, dynamic. Yeah. What would you get? Everybody's right. Heard of the SM58s and 57s.
SM57 and 58 are kind of the same mic.
Yep.
Different pop screen
yep.
on them.
Yep.
And that's a great microphone.
Yeah.
Totally should have one of those. I would, you know, I was saying earlier when we started the studio upstairs, we had a couple of 57s.
Uh-huh.
I had an Audio Technica 4033,
mm-hmm.
which you can find those for $250, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great condenser mic. I still use it on a loud singer, like mm-hmm. great for punk rock singer for condenser. I recently just got a 4050, which is kind of the same mic with a dual diaphragm. So it will do omni and figure eight and cardioid, whereas the 4033 is just cardioid. And then if you can find a ribbon mic, there's lots of different ribbon mics and some are fairly affordable. That's another flavor that's great to have. So if I, you know, was going to buy three microphones, I'd get a dynamic like a 57,
okay,
a condenser like the 4033, and a ribbon. I know Shiny Box is a company that's local that makes cool ribbon mics that are affordable. I think Cascade makes. There's a you guys have
we have a Cascade.
Fathead. You guys have the Fathead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think we found out about through Bela Fleck, maybe.
Okay.
Don't quote me on
those
that.
Those are great.
But
yeah. Yeah. I use the Royers, and then I have a couple of Coles. Those are a little more expensive. They're up in the $1,200. But I use them on drums. I use them on horns. Sometimes I use them on singers.
Uh-huh.
Love them. They're great. So, yeah, that's great to have those kind of different flavors, and then you can experiment with what works for you. Acoustic guitar, generally, you know, a condenser mic is the way to go.
Okay.
Sometimes the small diaphragm condenser mic is a good way to go. A little different than a vocal mic.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but unlike lots of other pieces of gear, most recording gear kind of holds its value.
Yes.
Okay.
I would say not so much with interfaces, though.
Sure.
Interfaces come and go, and they lose value like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another place where you can invest, and maybe it'll retain its value. The conversion that we're using, I mentioned, it's the IZ-ADA, which comes from the lineage of the radar recorders. And
okay.
I think that it's going to hold its value pretty well over the course of its life. But it'll still end up in a landfill at some point. All right. Whereas the Mic Pre, probably not. I mean, the Mic Pre's that we're recording through right now were built in 1968 for a console that was used at Stax Studio, and they're still valuable.
Yeah.
Probably because they're, you know, built for Stax, they're valuable, but they sound incredible. And they're very musical. So if it's a well-built piece of gear, it should last.
Mm-hmm.
Just not conversion.
Okay. I have dozens of questions that were submitted to us. And again, this is very 101, folks, but we'll get geeky as we always do with everything Fretboard Journal. I just thought I'd break the ice with you.
I mean, do we want to talk a little about our idea of starting a podcast about all of this?
Yeah, we should, which is basically... like I said, listener Dave in Denver said, why isn't there a Truth About Recording podcast?
Yeah.
And we poked around, and I'm sure folks will chime in and say, but there are podcasts that cover this and this. But I don't think there are podcasts that sort of do the car talk, Truth About Vintage Amps for folks who want to record. Maybe there are.
Yeah.
Correct me if
I'm
wrong.
I guess where we're leading with this is that that might become a thing.
Yeah.
We're hoping it'll become a thing.
And Johnny, I'm deeming you the host.
Okay.
Start reading those Sweetwater catalogs.
What I like about this is that then I don't have to be the expert. Then I can call up my friends who can be the experts and ask them the questions.
Yes.
That's much more interesting to
me. So you will be the me on the AM podcast with an all-star array of experts, of skips.
Yeah.
And I think it could be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I've already reached out to a couple people. So we have Kurt Block, who's a young, fresh fellow and fastback and produces lots of great records.
Yeah.
Just talked to Jack Endino, who you probably know who is. famous grunge producer, among mm-hmm. other things. Mm-hmm. And then Ed Brooks, who's a mastering engineer here in town, mm-hmm. very knowledgeable and great on the acoustics, helped me a ton with putting this place together, really knows his stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and many others.
Yeah. So I'm anticipating, and you're the host, so you tell me if I'm way off, but unlike the rapid fire treatment of the Amp podcast where we're going through questions a mile a minute, we might actually go a little deeper down these rabbit holes because sure. we have these experts on the line.
Right. Yeah.
But it's going to be fun, something for folks to look forward to in 2021.
Yeah. I'm curious if how we'll break it up. It could be that, you know, there's a question that requires 3 phone calls.
Oh man, it's a lot of work for you. I'm sorry.
Well, it might be kind of cool to hear, you know, 3 different takes on the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, one of the things about this is that everybody kind of approaches it in a different way.
Yeah.
We all figure out things that work for us, but, you know, like what I like to do on a drum kit is totally different than what Kurt likes to do on a drum kit. I love the sounds that he gets. I think he likes the sounds I get, but it's, you know, just different routes.
Sure.
So,
and it sounds like it's totally room dependent too. You know how this room sounds the best from hundreds of recordings.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's also personal taste, you know. Yeah. Do you like condensers on the overheads or ribbons?
Yeah. So as I often say on the Amplifier podcast, folks should send questions or voice memos to podcast@fretboardjournal.com. Yeah. And I'll start bombarding Johnny with those.
Great.
But I'm trying to think of what else.
What am I getting into?
We do, so just to bring it back home to what started this, which is our Amplifier podcast, recording an amplifier. What mic do you love? Or are there a bunch of different mics depending on the amps?
Yeah. I love the Royer 121 on most guitar amps.
Okay.
And that's a ribbon mic. It's got a very natural top end, and it likes EQ. So you can, if you want it a little brighter, it doesn't hurt to turn up the treble on your EQ knob.
Okay.
That's not always the case with a condenser mic or a 57. Sometimes adding top end makes them a little harsh and brittle.
Is that Royer expensive?
It's a $1,200 mic. Yeah.
Okay. So it's up there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually one of the first, like, oh, I'm spending $1,200 on a piece of recording gear. And I did that, I think, 13 years ago and still use it all the time.
It's still worth that much?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, right. Yeah. SM57 is a great, you know, electric guitar mic.
Yeah.
And placement, you know, like take that SM57 and move it around the cone.
Yeah.
See where it works. And there's a lot of different tones that you can get. The other thing, and we were talking about this with, you know, acoustic instruments, pull it back from the amp. Mm-hmm. Like you see people on stage miking things as close as possible to get as much separation as possible.
Yeah.
Which makes sense on a loud stage with a loud rock band.
Yeah.
You want that separation. But in a studio or in a recording situation, you don't have to be a half an inch from the cone of the speaker.
Yeah.
Sometimes it sounds better to pull it back, you know, 10 inches, foot and a half, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds more natural.
We all have that indelible memory of our favorite artists with like the gaffer tape square of where the mic goes when they're
exactly.
on stage.
Yeah.
But play with that.
Right. That makes a huge difference. Sometimes the condenser mic on an electric guitar is great too.
Yeah.
Oftentimes with the condenser, you'll need to use the pad on the mic. I don't know if you know this, but a condenser mic has an amplifier circuit built into the body of the mic.
Okay.
Because the signal's coming off the capsule is very quiet, so it needs to be boosted before it travels down the mic cable mm-hmm. to your mic pre. The reason why there's a pad on that mic is that you can overload that circuit in the mic quite easily.
Okay.
Like if you put it next to a drum, it'll go crunch. And it's just in the mic that it's distorting. So use your pad to bring the level down. If it's a loud guitar amp, that'll make a better recording with a condenser mic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know everything I've said so far has probably made people roll their eyes back 1,000 times, but I'm going to do one more time, which is whenever I hear the word ribbon mic, my brain goes to, that sounds like it's really delicate and needs to be babied. Do these things require maintenance? I mean, an SM57 or 8.
Right,
you can drop it in your PAPS and be fine for the rest of the
night. A ribbon is much more delicate than most, and it's prone to, you know, it doesn't like air blasts.
Okay.
So if you're, you know, recording a vocal, use a couple of pop filters if you can. These Stedmans are good at redirecting your air blasts.
Okay.
The cloth ones do a good job of, you know, stopping the air.
Mm-hmm.
The Coles mics, when I got those, somebody came to the studio, I'm not going to mention their name, and stuck it in front of a loud-ass Marshall.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say.
Right on the speaker. And then they were like, it just stopped working. It was weird. So I took the other one and I put that down there instead. like, you didn't do that, did you? But yeah, it snapped the ribbon. And it's because of the low end moves the air so much.
Wow.
That, you know, so the Coles are pretty delicate. The Royer is designed to put in front of a guitar amp.
Okay.
That's, they, you know, positioned the ribbon further back, I think, and in the magnet field that it sits in, they did something to make it more durable.
All right.
But yeah, you can put that in front of a loud guitar amp and it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But yeah, they're more delicate.
Boy. This is just the tip of the iceberg, obviously.
What else you got?
What else do I have? Well, let's see. Dano, listener Dano, was wondering... he wants to know about navigating the mastering process when you're sending a mastering house your own mixes. Does it vary for music streaming platforms, social media, or do you just send one set of files? And
well, I think mastering houses will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, those numbers kind of change all the time. Mm-hmm. But one of the cool things that has happened in the last, you know, since streaming kind of took over, mm-hmm. is that the loudness war that existed for so long with CDs, mm-hmm. has kind of been negated by streaming, because Spotify and Apple Music will actually turn your song down if it goes over the standard,
mm-hmm.
for volume.
Okay.
So if you're mastering your thing too hot, it's not going to be any hotter on Spotify.
Okay.
So there's kind of a target goal for where you want to have it.
Yeah.
And your mastering engineer can help guide you on that. And they're the ones who really, that's part of their job, is to be up on, you know, what's it going to sound like when it goes up to Spotify and comes back down.
Yeah.
And yeah, there is a sweet spot in there. You don't want it to be too quiet still.
Yeah.
Still pays to get it mastered fairly loud.
Yeah.
But yeah. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah. And I'm going to end on this question, which is pretty broad and open-ended. Obviously, I think most folks out there listening are going to want to be able to do DIY stuff at home and make their recording sound as good as possible. Talk to me about you talking about the mastering person. I can understand how you would interview or audition or vet a producer, engineer,
uh-huh.
people who've recorded records and you've admired them. You would gravitate towards that producer.
Sure. Right. Because you can recognize a sound.
You can recognize a sound. Yeah. But for mastering, how do you interview and audition and decide if a mastering person is right for you? And then I guess let's backtrack and decide, what are the questions folks should ask a future producer?
Okay. So the mastering folks, I mean, obviously you look at their discography and and then listen to the
how many Grammys and gold records they have.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little of that, like, who have they worked with? Is that cool? But, you know, for sure, listening to the work that's come out of that place too can tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to say because some of that reflects upon the band and the mixing engineer and all of that. But if you can sample a little bit of it and also, you know, compare that to other records that you like, you know, it's easier if you have a CD and you can put a CD in and, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, you can do that. That's important. And then, you know, have a conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people are totally up for talking to you,
mm-hmm.
and preparing you for what they want. For me, like, I've worked with a lot of different people, but I've found a couple people who will push back for me as a mixer, and I like that. Like, I want to have somebody who says to me, your work is good, but you need to work on these areas. You know, bass is weak. You know, actually, when I moved into this room, all of a sudden I was mixing things brighter. And it's just because I hadn't figured this place out yet.
Mm-hmm. You got the yellow walls.
But that was like, you know, okay, well, I have to think about my monitoring. I have to, you know, go back to the thing where I'm checking on multiple sources and relearn how it's translating.
Okay.
But it's good to have somebody to tell me, this is where you need to work. Or, you know, am I printing my mixes too hot? Because that's another thing that mastering engineers they need to have a little headroom to work with. Like if you're slamming it to the top of the level, then you're not giving them much to work with. So sure. Leave some dynamic range for them. And that's also a conversation. If you're mixing your own record, talk to your mastering engineer about how hot is acceptable for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do people, you don't have to name names, although mm-hmm. it would be fun if you did. Do potential clients ever come to you and you know they can pay the bills, but you just turn them down because it's not a good fit?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's, if they're asking me to produce their record, mm-hmm. absolutely. There's also some projects where that is not less my role. Like they have a clear idea of it. There's somebody in the band who's going to take that part of it, the artistic focus of the record, and I can do my job as a recording engineer and everybody's happy.
Okay.
But if they come to me and they want me to produce it, like I have to feel like I understand the songs and feel like I can bring something to it. Otherwise, it's better if I just say, "Yeah, I'm not the guy."
Yeah.
Yeah. Cuz you know, if I'm not excited about it and feeling like it's coming some, you know, I'm taking it somewhere and making it better, then I'm going to be unhappy and not loving it. And then the artist is getting crap from me. So,
Then I guess the continuation of that thought would be, I imagine that happens on the mastering side as well. Mastering people turning down clients because it's not a good fit or not really.
Maybe. I mean, that it's possible, but it's less of a commitment when you master a record because mm-hmm. you pretty much are working on it for a day or two, or mm-hmm. you know, maybe it comes back a couple times around and you're tweaking it and finishing it off. But it's a less of an artistic journey than taking a song from a idea and a demo and turning it into a final thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's possible. I'm sure that there's some mastering engineers that after having mastered a couple of records for a particular producer say, yeah, I'm not really interested in working with his material because it's not for me.
Yeah.
That's possible.
Okay.
And I would hope they would, you know.
Yeah.
If it's not for them, then yeah, there's lots of people doing it out there. You can find somebody who's a better fit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we part, what is one track that you are the most proud of that everyone can go race over to Spotify and hear a shitty version of?
I'm so bad at this. one track.
I should have prepped you with these questions instead. I'm just.
Yeah. Well, I think.
Can be a few.
Well, so what about that Rusty Willoughby Cobirds Unite record?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great record that I'm super proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Probably from my early career, I would point to the band The Kent Three and their album Spells. That was done at Egg Studio, recorded and mixed in 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Great record. I like the last couple Mudhoney records I've worked on. Mm-hmm. Those sound really good.
Yeah.
Maggie Bjorklund's Coming Home record, I'm very proud of.
All right.
The Tripwire has just put out a new EP that's great that I recorded, you know, some of it. And actually, Kurt Block recorded one at his place, and Jack and Dino did tracking for a couple. I mixed the most of it.
All right.
Gosh, I don't know.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I'm the worst self-promoter.
It's all right. You have episode after episode of self-promote. Exactly.
I'll make a list of all the great things I've done.
Yeah. Well, Johnny, I'm really excited about this.
Yeah,
I'm
me
excited
too.
To see where this goes, as with so many of our projects, they kind of take on a life of their own, and that's what makes it cool.
Hopefully, yeah. I'm excited to see where it goes as well.
Yeah.
I'm excited to ask some other people some questions.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So keep questions or send questions to podcast@fretboardjournal.com or voice memos. Voice memos end up sounding better than a lot of phone line voicemails.
Yeah.
So we love those, and everybody's got a smartphone in front of them that can do those. And thanks for doing this, Johnny.
Thank you, Jason.